The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Hi, everybody. Coming up, Nicole tells your fortune looking ahead. So get out your crystal and stay tuned with Mistress Nicole. All dressed in leather, you won't forget her. You want to love her and you won't let go. Who's that woman, crazy woman, Nicole?
Welcome to a Wednesday, everybody. I always have to double check and remember it's Wednesday. And I know it's Wednesday because yesterday was Tuesday. It was Election Day. And, oh, thank you, Georgia. Georgia, I'd play a song for you, but I would get copyright violated by YouTube. And I don't want to do that, certainly not today, because we got a lot to take care of today. So my guest today is an old colleague of mine, somebody that I worked with 30 years ago. Mark and Brian had the number one morning show in Los Angeles during the time that I produced their show. Well, Mark Thompson has written a book, and the book was just released yesterday. It is called Don't Bump the Record, Kid, My Adventures with Mark and Brian. And Mark's been on the show before, but, you know, after reading the book, I learned a few things that I didn't know were going on at the time I was there. So it gives me kind of a different perspective. Plus, you know, I've been getting ready to move. We're finally leaving Florida, and I'm a pack rat, in case you didn't know. And I've been going through stuff and finding all kinds of videos and audio tapes and stuff. And so I have a feeling that I'm going to share some stuff with Mark today that he may not have heard or seen in about 30 years. So I promise you we'll have fun. We'll have lots of memories. We'll see where the hour brings us. So I should start with, you know, the intro that I played today, the all dressed in leather, this one. You know, this that I play occasionally from time to time, use different intros on the show.
Hi, everybody. Coming up.
This one.
Nicole.
Does the voice sound familiar? Because that's Chris Isaac singing. This wasn't recorded at KLOS, but at the station I went to after KLOS, after I worked with Mark and Brian. But I first met Chris Isaac when he guested on the Mark and Brian show. And he had just his career just took off because the song, I'm drawing a blank on it. You know, it's a big hit. Was featured in a movie, and it was a few years old already. And David Lynch put him in a movie, and all of a sudden the song took off, and the rest was history. I do have a Chris Isaac story from that. That maybe I'll share later or another day. Anyway, before Mark joins us, though, I said, give me about 15 minutes so I can get started because we need to celebrate. Yes. So it was a long election, too long. And this is going to be the topic of a rant in a future show. But we here in the United States are suckers. We've spent billions of dollars on this campaign, on this election cycle, on a midterm election cycle. And it's like nobody even thinks twice about it. All the money that is solicited from average people, many of whom are having trouble paying the bills, but they're asked to pony up $5, $10, $27, $2,800 to donate to a candidate. Wicked Game. Thank you, Lauren. Old age. Wicked Game was the song. Thank you. I think it's criminal. We should all check off the little box on our income tax returns that says, I would like to donate $3 to the presidential campaign fund. It doesn't cost you anything. It comes off the top. But if we did that, we wouldn't, then elections would be financed basically by the government, we shouldn't have to reach into our pocketbook, because you know where the money goes, don't you? We'll talk about this more with Howie Klein tomorrow, because he can go off on it. But the money goes to contractors. Yes, some money goes to the candidate, but that gets spent on mostly on television ads. And it's a waste. It is the biggest, most massive waste of money ever. Billions of dollars were spent on ads for this campaign. Now, it came out, right? Doug in the chat room says, if I recall correctly, $210 million on the Warnock-Walker race. And again, it goes to for TV ads mostly, and to consultants, the consultants who buy the advertising. It's a scam. And we are throwing away money that could be so much put to so much better use. So we'll get into that. But that said, this happened last night.
Thank you from the bottom of my heart. And to God be the glory.
Okay. Was that part really necessary? I guess he's a reverend, but come on, man.
Come on, man.
Come on, man.
For the great things that God has done.
Okay, God didn't do it. Your supporters did. You did.
And after a hard-fought campaign.
Yeah.
Or should I say campaigns?
Yes, because there were four. In the last 2 years, four he had to run.
It is my honor to utter the four most powerful words ever spoken in a democracy. The people have spoken.
Oh, yeah. The people have spoken. Yeah, you see, now, I like Raphael Warnock. I really, really do. And I don't mind that he's a preacher. That's, you know, that was his job before, and I guess he still goes home to Atlanta and preaches at the same church behind the pulpit that Martin Luther King Jr. used to preach from. That's a pretty high bar. That's cool. But we need to have that separation between church and state. And I hate it when everything is about God. It doesn't have to be. Just saying. But that's me. That's me. Diane in the chat room says, LOL, when I heard that last night, I knew it would bug Nicole. It bugged the shit out of me. Now, let me tell you something else that's going to surprise you. I heard a little bit of Herschel Walker's concession speech, such as it was. Let me play a little bit of it for you. I think it will surprise you, too.
You know, I'm always going to give... Thank my Lord and Savior Jesus Christ.
Okay, and you know,
and
there he goes.
And I'm going to acknowledge my wife, Julie, because she's with me, and she's been through a tough
Okay,
time.
I meant to cue into a different part, not this part.
I
want to
thank
all
you as well, because we've had a tough journey, have we not?
We have.
One of the things I said is when they called the race, I said the numbers doesn't look like they're going to add up. But one of the things I want to tell all of you is you never stop dreaming. I don't want any of you to stop dreaming. I don't want any of you to stop believing in America. I want you to believe in America and continue to believe in the Constitution and believe in our elected officials most of all. Continue to pray for them, because all the prayers you...
Okay, now it gets into the prayer stuff. But did you hear that part? I want you to believe in America, believe in our elected officials, believe in the Constitution. Who is that masked man? Let me tell you something. Herschel Walker, you're even stupider than I thought. Because if you're capable of that... In your concession speech, if he had done that all along, I hate to say it, if he had done that all along, he could have won. He lost because he's batshit fucking crazy. And last night he made sense. He said the right things, probably because Donald Trump wasn't in his ear, you know? Oh my God. So, the election is now over. And guess what? So now we get to roll over and go immediately into the 2024 elections. We should not. That should get a big, big buzzer. Oh, there you go. Because no, we should do it like other countries where they limit the electioneering, the campaigning, the length of the campaign to like 5-6 weeks. Here it goes on for 2 years. So I figured we had great news last night, the outcome we wanted. Now the Senate is under Democratic control. It's not an equal split. It's 51-49. So the committees will not be evenly split anymore. Chuck Schumer will be majority leader again. Mitch McConnell, the turtle, will be minority leader, and they'll still try to stop everything. But it's okay because they won't be able to stop everything as easily as they've been. Now, it's still not going to be a cakewalk. We don't have 60 votes on the Democratic side, but at least it's 51-49. It's no longer 50-50. Kamala Harris will not be the tiebreaker anymore. So partay. It's time to partay. So I'll tell you what, since this was all the time I needed, but I told Mark to be here like at 15 after. So we're going to start with some of the audio that I pulled. And so let me, I mentioned Mark Thompson will be here. And I was the producer of the Mark and Brian show for 4 years from July, the beginning of July 1994 to the beginning of July. I'm sorry, beginning of July 1990 to the beginning of July 1994, almost to the day, like 4 years. I produced not only a daily radio show, but each year a big Christmas show, two birthday shows, one for Mark, one for Brian, the day before Thanksgiving Day parade. We did chick nights and dude nights and drive-ins and events and just a lot of stuff. But the Christmas shows were pretty awesome. And so I'm going to start today, because it is this time of year, with a song. This was recorded, I believe, at the Christmas show 1992 at the Palladium, first year we moved to the Palladium. And I think it was the first year we moved to the Palladium. And you may recall, Bill Mumy was on this program a few weeks ago, and we played a song by The Generators. Well, The Generators backed up a woman named Sarah Taylor, who's a good friend of Bill's, on a song that Bill wrote and they recorded together. It is one of my favorite, and you know how I feel about Christmas songs. It's one of my favorite Christmas songs, and it is. It's a Christmas song. So here it is. Sarah Taylor and The Generators, recorded at the Mark and Brian Christmas show in 1992. Merry Christmas, everybody.
Yep.
Kind of hoping Miss Aluminum Tree would like to do that, too.
All right, you might have heard on the program the last couple of weeks, we had Billy Mumy on the program with some of his buds about a month ago, and we have been playing a song he sent us on tape that he just thought we might enjoy hearing.
Now, he wrote and produced this song, and it features a wonderful singer named Sarah Taylor. We saw her last night, and she does this better live than you've heard it played on the show.
Yeah, this ought to give you the Christmas spirit. Everybody, please welcome The Generators.
Good morning, everybody. Got some presents for Santa. He's got a big one for me. Outside it snows. I take off all my clothes. Wait for Santa underneath my tree. He squeezes into my hot chimney. It's all so warm and tight. On the roof I hear his reindeer. I'm so very glad he came here. It's only once a year, but what a night. Santa Claus takes a pause from his long night of delivering. His big nose poke and shoe get cold. His jolly butt's all shivering. I offer Santa my cookies. He loves to put them into his mouth. So very, these tickles. I'm so very glad it tickles so what I meant. Santa Claus takes the balls from his long night of delivery. His big North Pole can sugar coat his jolly butts all shivering. Oh, Santa, I love my present. What else is in that big bag? Santa and I share a ciggy. Then I help him back into his red suit. I know he has to go, he just says so. I can't help it, he's so cute. Santa Claus takes a pause from his long night of delivering. His big North Pole can sugarcoat his jolly butts all shivering. Yeah, I got some presents for Santa. He's got a big one for me. On the roof I hear his reindeer. I take off all my clothes and wait for Santa. Take off all my clothes, I'm waiting for Santa. Take off all my clothes, I'm waiting for Santa. Underneath my tree.
The Generators.
The Generators, thank you. Sarah Taylor. Thank you. And the voice you heard just saying that joins us now. That is Mark Thompson, author of the new book, Don't Bump the Record, Kid, My Adventures with Mark and Brian. Hey there, Mark.
Good morning or good afternoon.
It's afternoon. You've been doing a lot of interviews lately for the book, I know. So you're a little, and you're out in LA now, aren't you?
I am.
You are, because you launched the book there, and you had a big event this weekend. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, congratulations on the book. That's a big undertaking.
Thank you. Yeah, it was 3 years.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, a year to get the initial draft done, another year to edit, add, clean up, do this, do that, and then another year to get ready for the show, the prep, adding team of people that are going to help us get it done. So, yeah, it's been a good 3 years, I would think.
And I got to say, the proceeds all go for a great cause. Now, I didn't know this when we worked together, because you weren't talking much about animals, but you're as much of an animal lover as I am. Mm-hmm. All the proceeds go to Allison Eastwood's animal sanctuary and rescue?
Yeah, Allison Eastwood and her volunteers, they go into kill shelters. Mm-hmm. And they say, we want all of the animals that are scheduled to be put down, and they take them.
Good for them.
And right now they're taking them back to their individual homes to give them veterinary care, food, water, that kind of thing. Her hope, her goal, her plan is to build this giant rescue center where these animals can be taken, given veterinary care, a warm place to sleep, good food, and teach the public that if you'd like to have an animal, come there. Mm-hmm. And you can get your, so her heart is 100% pure and in the right place. And I join her in that. So whatever money we can generate through this, 100% of the proceeds goes to that.
That's awesome. That's really, really awesome. You know, all my dogs have been all rescues. Right now we've got Jackson. He's Jackson Brown is his name. But because he's brown with big eyes, and yeah, kind of reminded me of him, but yeah, he's an old man now, but yeah, they're the best. And I love that she did. Now, did you meet Allison Eastwood? Did you know her? Because we met Clint. He came to our Christmas show my final year with you guys, because we always had a celebrity read. 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, and he was the last one when I was there in 93.
Clint Eastwood.
Wasn't it Clint Eastwood? Wasn't it Clint Eastwood? It was, okay.
Jack Palance.
We had Jack Palance, we had Burgess Meredith, and we had Tony Curtis my first 3 years. The fourth year, I believe, was Clint Eastwood. Wasn't he smoking weed in the dressing room at the Palladium?
No, that was rumored to be Charlton Heston.
Oh, it was Charlton Heston. It was Charlton Heston.
I'm very capable of not remembering certain things, but
I would have remembered
when Clint came.
Right. Clint Eastwood, Charlton Heston, you know, both Republicans, gun nuts. So what do I know? That's where my mind goes. All right. So I screwed that one up. So, and, you know, I noticed, I thought you had a few lapses in the book, actually got years, I think, juxtaposed. But it's hard because we're going back. You went back much longer than I went back with you. You and Brian started together in Birmingham. Mm-hmm. And that's where you start the book, as you guys got together. What year did you two, were you put together?
1985. Our first show was April 16th, 1985. Mm-hmm. And then our last show was August 17th, 2012. So that was a 27-year run.
Right. And I was only with you guys for 4 years. I was 90 to 94. For me, that was, you know, that was a lifetime. But the show ended for me in 94 when I left, but you kept going for close to another 18 years. So mm-hmm. there's a lot of history there.
No question. Yeah. It was a unique, unbelievably wonderful and yet difficult ride to take, just as life is. Nothing's ever great every single day. So you have to kind of deal with the ups and the downs at the same time.
Right. And you did. In this book, you dug down deep and talked about things that you certainly never did when I knew you back then. Things that were never said, either to me or apparently to Brian. You guys didn't talk about the deep, heavy shit going on in your heads at the time. But I think that was also partly a sign of the times. I don't think we talked about feelings as much back then.
Are you referring to the anxiety part?
Yeah.
Yeah. At that point, I felt like there was a stigma. I know that I was terrified that people would find out that I was going through that, because it was, first of all, when it first started, I didn't know what it was. I had no idea that, you know, when somebody said, you know, I have anxiety, I thought they were nervous about something. I didn't realize what this was, mm-hmm. because I wouldn't wish this on anyone. So there was that. It started and I didn't know what it was. And that was very frightening. And it wasn't until it was basically diagnosed. Then, as odd as it may sound, that made me feel a little bit better that I wasn't the only one dealing with this, because you feel like you're going crazy. So, that was the big fear. But, you know, obviously I was able to get some therapy and talk it through and figure it out and get a grasp on it. And when I was in the process of writing the book, even before I started writing the book, I knew I was probably going to address it, because I had seen other people, not just with anxiety, but people talk about whatever struggles they may have. And we're all human beings. We're all in this thing together. And just because we may be successful or famous or pretty or whatever the thing may be, we have our difficulties. And it's always been, to me, helpful when they say, I suffered with this, I went through this. And so I thought that I would.
And I'm glad you did. I'll tell you something. You know, I've suffered from depression since adolescence. And even during the 4 years we were together, I tried to keep those things you keep private. But I had, I've battled depression my entire adult life. And I had days, you know, sitting in that studio with you guys when, it was hard to keep it in check. And so it's now to go back and read your book and see that you're going through something different but similar. It's like, oh my God, why didn't we just talk? Why, you know, if we could have talked about it and maybe it would have helped us both. I don't know.
It's possible. But as I said, I really didn't I think I waited months before I mentioned it to my wife. Wow. Only after repeated questions of what's going on with you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and you can lie your way through that just so often. And my main motivation behind that, I wasn't worried per se about sharing it with her. or to let her know that I was struggling. But I didn't want her to dote on me. It was the last thing I wanted. And I think maybe that's fairly common for people that are going through something mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. I was kind of like, just let me work this out. I'll figure it out. I've got this. And so her first reaction was, we need to go to the doctor and find out. So I went to a general practitioner and filled him in. He asked me specifically what was going on. I told him, and he said, it sounds like general anxiety to me. Let's get you to somebody who can help you. So I went and did that. And that began the very long, tedious process of talking about this and talking mm-hmm. about that. But luckily, I did go to, once the general practitioner told me it sounded like general anxiety, I went to somebody who specialized in that. I didn't want to go to somebody who, you know, had heard of it and let's see if we can figure it out. I wanted to go to somebody who really kind of did that. And it wound up being a very good move on my part, although be it just tedious and just forever. And good Lord, why? You know, we all just want to go into the doctor, find out what's wrong, and then you give me
and then fix
a
it.
Pill. Give me a pill. Now, I will say the psychiatrist did give me Xanax.
Uh-huh.
And I went home and I took one and I knew that I would never take it again.
Huh.
Because I was immediately back to normal. I felt euphoric. I felt fantastic. And I knew this is what people get hooked on.
Yeah.
So I threw them in the drawer and I thought, I'm going to work this out. I'm going to figure it out. I got this. And so I didn't travel down that path, but I really felt that it would be, because I had made the decision before I started writing the book that I'm going to be honest about this. I'm not going to be rude, but I'm going to tell the truth about what the Mark and Brian years meant to me, what it did for me, what it did to me. And I did. I walked that very fine line, because when you decide you're going to be honest about something, there's honest and there's just being a dick. And I just didn't want to get into that part of it. I'm not that kind of person. And I didn't want the book to be a tell-all. The very first thing my publicist said, is this salacious? Is there a lot of juicy stuff? And I said, not really, not like you're talking. So I was completely honest with the things that I went through and dealt with and what it did for me and all that kind of stuff. But I did it without, you know, naming names and telling details. Like, you're married. What is it, perfect? Of course not. Are you going to go to work and tell everybody about the big fight you had with your wife or your husband? No, you're not, or mm-hmm. you shouldn't.
Right.
So I kind of walked that path. I felt through it.
Yeah, you did. And you did it. You did a very good job of it. And, you know, and for the reader who was probably a very long-term listener of the show, mm-hmm. They're thinking, what, you know, what was going on, what their perception of things was then. For me, because I had a front row seat, you know, it was different. And I'm trying to relate to what I was going through and what you were going through and things we never talked about. We talked about seeming almost everything on the air. We were like an open book on the air. We talked about our sex lives. We talked about, you know, what we did, but we didn't get into those feelings. We didn't get into heavy shit, but I guess that's not what you do on a morning radio show anyway. So
yeah, this was an entertainment based morning radio program. And I just don't know how funny it would have been. I go, hey guys, I've got some anxiety.
Right. Right. Exactly.
So yeah, it's just not the kind of topic you're going to bring.
But so you did a nice job in the book of telling that situation, bringing us into what you were experiencing at the time and, mm-hmm. you know, what the show was about. You did, you know, I was wondering if you'd come up with like some of your favorite bits, or I know I've got some of my favorites from my time with you guys, some of the things that we pulled off that I look back on now 30 years later and go, holy shit. And it's funny because I read the book now a couple of months ago. And so again, my memory is foggy as to what you wrote about and what you didn't. Did you spend much time in the book on the Elvis Bob?
You know, I don't even know if I mentioned it.
I don't know if you did either.
And there's so many things that we did that you can, you know, you can mention it, you can get into it. And some you can just mention, others have a story to them. Yeah, but I don't think I got into the Elvis box.
I don't think you did either. You told about the Elvis, obviously your trip to Graceland, which was before I joined you guys. You talked about the Elvis head at the Rose Bowl parade, but shortly, I joined you, the show, in July, the beginning of July of 1990. In August of 1990, I don't recall how it happened, but one day on the air, you and Brian were talking about the Bob's Big Boy. There was a Bob's Big Boy restaurant right straight up La Cienega Boulevard. You kept calling it Shoney's because I guess in Alabama it was Shoney's Big Boy.
It was.
And yeah, you constantly say it. I'm like, what the hell is Shoney's? Anyway.
It's the same as
it's
California.
Hardee's, right?
It's Carl's Jr.
Right.
And in the South, it's Hardee's.
Exactly. It's the same thing. So that was Shoney's, Bob's Big Boy. And people should remember the statue. Well, you guys had a fixation on Elvis Presley.
Well, you have to admit that the Bob's Big Boy with that hair flip, that thing,
right?
He does have an Elvis-esque thing going.
Oh, without a doubt. In fact, hold on. Can I? Well, you know what? I don't want to spoil it yet. Let me tell you what's going on here. I have been in touch with some listeners, and one of them sent me a tape. This man, I'm blanking on his name. It'll come to me, I promise, before we're done. He was our official videographer for the first Elvis Bob stunt.
Wow.
Do you remember what it was?
Are you talking about Vegas?
No, that was later. That was like a year later.
Oh, you're talking about Capitol Records building.
I'm talking about the Capitol Records building. Yeah. So I don't know how you guys came up with the idea, but you decided we're going to go in the Mark and Brian mobile down to that Bob's Big Boy, steal the Bob's Big Boy statue, take it, and convert it into Elvis and put him on top of the Capitol Records building because Elvis always wanted to be on Capitol Records.
So we're the ones that's going to do it.
Right. So this listener who was the official videographer sent me some video, sent me the raw video, and I'm going to share a little bit of it with you. This is right after we got the Bob's Big Boy back to the station. And do you see the woman you're talking to there? You know who that is?
Let's measure the stomach first.
That was Ricky. She was like, she designed Elvis's Vegas costumes. And so she came down and said she would design the costume to transform Bob's Big Boy into the Elvis Bob.
Wow.
So there we are. Out. This is the old building because this was still 1990. Out behind where we used to go smoke, although we could smoke inside the building at the time. And we have the Bob's Big Boy there, and you guys are measuring it for the transformation, right?
Wow.
So I'm going to forward a little bit. We wound up taking it in the car to a car wash because you wanted to. Here, listen to you and Mark, you and Brian on the air.
They're coming right back after that to begin work on the outfit for the king today. So we're going to try to get to this other car wash during this next song, and we're going to deal with it then.
Okay, so the funny thing is, do you look at those microphones that you're carrying? This was 1990. This was you may have had a car phone at the time, but this was before cell phones. And our engineers rigged up this remote pack, this giant backpack with two big old cell phones with those weird microphones, so that you guys could get out of the studio and go do stupid shit like this.
Well, the other thing, and it's not that I'd forgotten, I just hadn't thought about it, but what we're holding, those little microphones were really just little bitty. Those things we're holding are items that we gave away on the air as lovely parting gifts. Those are Mark and Brian branding irons.
Oh my God.
And they took those and glued the microphones to the top of them.
That's so funny. So here we are at the car wash. You're trying to get the thing through the car wash. We do the whole thing. And then, all right, so I'm gonna push through a little bit. It was just silly, silly, fun stuff. And there we are, I guess, heading back to the radio station. And then, hold on. So then
looking
the next
good.
Day, the Elvis Bob is delivered The Elvis Bob is transformed, and now we're driving in Robert's pickup truck to the Capitol Records building.
Looks like that thing's about to fall apart right there on the road.
Right, but it didn't. We made it all the way there, and you can see the lovely streets of La Cienega Boulevard. We're driving down there. A couple of things, though, that people didn't realize, because it sounded like we just ran up to the Bob's Big Boy and stole the statue. And when I actually cleared it with the management ahead of time. I called. I said, we want to do this radio bit. We want to take it. And they go for it. Help yourself. Have fun. Which surprised the hell out of me.
That was smart on your part.
Oh, of course. Well,
otherwise, it would have been theft.
Of course. Right. You would have been in jail. Then Capitol Records. I don't know. Something. But I can't believe. And they never asked for it back. They never asked for money. They never asked for the statue back or anything.
Crazy.
So really crazy. So, okay. So you're driving. Now we get up to Capitol Records. Do you remember how we got into Capitol Records?
I remember that we could not fit it on the elevator because the Bob's Big Boy is on this giant base. It's like a little statue you might have at home. It sits on this base, and the base was too big.
Right.
And so we had to get some. I think we started putting out calls that we had to cut the base some to get it on the elevator, and some guy showed up, and we sawed literally the sides of it off to get it on there.
Right. First time I ever heard the word sawzall. Which,
yes.
So there we are. You're out front. A big crowd is gathered there. They start. There's Ricky again, the costume designer. She showed up there. All right, let me push it forward a little. One of these days, when I get it fully edited, I'll post the whole thing on YouTube. But this is trying to get it in the elevator. So there you are. There they are sawing the bottom base to fit it in the elevator. So there was the main elevator. We get up to the top. And then there's another door it has to go through. Because I want to play that part for you because it's kind of funny. They're still sawing. There's you and Brian trying to get in.
There is actually the strongest point in the whole deal. That would never move.
So the Capitol Records building is round, so we're going through this round hallway.
If Elvis were in concert, we would be much like this, following the king.
Following
this,
right.
This is where the horns begin. It's too strange.
Okay, we're at the door, and it's a very, very narrow door.
Why don't we take this part of the base in first?
What's that, Robert?
Let's take this part of the base in first
to see if it fits.
What do you think his head should
what
be?
What about if you open those doors?
Is the door, the door off yet?
Okay, so this went on. This was all live on the air, by the way, in Morning Drive. There we are on the roof while the other guys are trying to figure it all out. Capitol Records building. Let's hear a little bit of you and...
This is the base in which the Elvis Presley, Elvis Bob will stand for two nights.
Specifically designed and specifically built so that folks traveling 101, which you may can see in the background, will be able to view the Elvis Bob through the weekend at night or day, whichever.
Elvis lights up. He's electrified.
He's the king, damn it.
And we don't even use any batteries, and the little lights we put in still light up. Another weird thing.
Just an aura of Elvis is all we need.
Okay, so then they finally get it out. Oh, and here's the moment. It's the moment. So there it is in the doorway. And the sawing still, because it has to get through this doorway and then up a flight of stairs and through another doorway.
Good Lord.
Yes. All right, let's bring it through because, you know, not a four-hour show. It's coming. Here we go.
And this gives me angst because I can't imagine this was a very good broadcast as we were sitting there trying to kill time while they were putting the sawzall on him.
Right. I don't think, and I don't have a copy of the show. That show doesn't exist. But look at the people, all the cars lined up down. There's a building across the way. Cars lined up on Hollywood Boulevard on, I think, Vine is where the Capitol Tower is. They're all beeping their horns. And you get the...
It's Elvis the going through puberty there, however.
Yeah, his voice was breaking a bit.
All right, let's go ahead and... Can we do this now, Bob?
No, we're waiting.
All right, so you put it up. All right, I want to get... Oh, okay, then this is Art Gladstone. Art Gladstone was always the keeper of the Bob, and he's the guy who lit him up. And yes. I understand Art passed away a couple of years ago.
I heard that. I'm sorry to hear it. Art was... great about that. We would take the Elvis Bob and transform him, depending on, I think he was Franken Bob, Dracubob, Santa Bob. He was any kind of Bob we could think of, and Art would be the one to deck him out. And he always looked great.
Always. And he would bring him to the events. He was the keeper of the Bob. But this was the very first event. So, okay, so they're going to put him up here. Here we go. Now, he's going up on the thing.
Yeah, this is the epitome of stupid.
Really stupid. But you guys, of course, had to sing a song, which was also kind of stupid.
I don't remember what it was.
it's, here, I think I cut right to it. And you hear everybody on the street screaming. This was, you know, 9:30 in the morning, maybe, at this point, because we had spent all morning getting up there. Okay, I edited it. Here we go. All right, so here's your song. We got to hear everybody. I mean, listen to that cacophony. There's Hollywood on a weekday morning. All right, sing the song, guys. Oh, you have to put on the scarf first. So he got the sunglasses and the scarf and the whole thing.
Of course, you got to have that.
Without a doubt. All right. This was really, really... And so this sat on top of the Capitol Records building all weekend. You can see it from the street. You could see it from the street. All right, I think... All right. Here we go. I think this is...
Are you ready?
All right.
It's the big boy, the Elvis Presley big boy. It's a heartbeat statue, got a bunch of hair, a real neat sideburns, and a whole big scar. It's the big boy, the Elvis Presley really big boy. Hunka, 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 hunka. Mama, baby, mama, baby, mama, baby. Thank you very much. The Elvis Presley really big boy. Yeah!
really, really, really stupid. But it was good-natured fun. And that was the thing about the show that captured hearts and minds. Is you, and the thing that attracted me to you two guys, too. You were two big, overgrown kids just trying to crack each other up.
Yeah. And that certainly made me laugh. I mean, did you see that? How ridiculous. You know, you did what? You took an Elvis Bob and you put, okay, good. Yeah.
Right.
Good.
Okay.
Yeah,
but
no, that was just, and that was work.
Oh,
that was a work day.
That was a work day. And by the way, my father, turns out, went to college with Joe Smith, who was the president of Capitol Records. So I called Joe Smith and I said, do you remember, I got through to him because I said I produced the Mark and Brian show and my father went to school with Joe. He was Willie Sandler, he was known as then. And Joe immediately got on the phone. He said, how is your dad? And we started talking and I went up and I met with him and he said, this is really stupid, but yeah, you can do it. So that's how we got the approval to do it. Now, a few minutes ago, you mentioned... Vegas. Was it Vegas? Well, we went to Las Vegas with the then Evil Kebab because at that point he was dressed up as Evil Knievel. And Evil Knievel came out to Vegas for this broadcast and where we launched, we had listeners who built a catapult who had done it for a turkey. First, we did a turkey launch. And then you asked, can you make it bigger to launch the Evil Kebab over the fountains at Caesar's Palace. And so there we are doing a live broadcast with Evil Knievel.
We would like you to be a little further over on the side. You need to check the wind and all the things that you would do if you were going to make a jump. And when everything is go for you, you give us the thumbs up and that lets us know it's time to throw it.
All right, we'll do that.
Ladies and gentlemen, Evil Knievel.
So there was Evil Knievel. He was there. One of my favorite parts, there were the Caesar's Palace people, you know, the kings and the queens and all that. Okay, so...
Crotch adjustment.
Okay, so before we did the launch, you had a special guest show up, and here he comes. Tom Jones. So Tom Jones, this is early in the morning. This is a live broadcast. We're at Vegas. The day started out pouring rain, cloudy. We had thousands of people out there.
God, you're looking good.
It's early, isn't it?
It is early, Tom. As you can see, Tom, we're going to be, you don't even know what's happening to you.
Yeah,
and what'd you feel about it?
Well, I think it's a good try.
We're going to throw that. Hopefully over those belts to hit that.
Okay, but before we did the launch, of course, Tom Jones had to perform, and you guys had to back him up, in case you don't remember.
Yeah, we really are.
Hey, Joe, so we had a band of listeners all right. Who backed him up.
B-flat.
B-flat's
unusual. Go for it.
And you and Brian, of course, were the masters at the brass. So you had to accompany.
We were that.
Today, yeah.
Can you imagine what Tom Jones was thinking at this
He's
point?
Cracking up. He cracks up throughout the whole thing. Ridiculous band. They're all dressed up as Elvis.
This is good stuff.
This is classic. Just cracks me up.
I think we're a little bit off.
A little, slightly. And look at that crowd. It was insane.
And for those wondering, when they launched it, it almost made
Hold on.
A little piece.
We've got it. So at this time, we were broadcasting in a number of markets, and you did a thing to get all the different markets involved. Okay, there's Linda, your lovely wife, right over there. Mm. We're waiting to hear from Evil Knievel, who gave us the go-ahead.
From the brand new capital of the world. All right, now here we go from Vegas. And as God is our witness, we thought the evil bomb of the high.
Almost.
So it came almost. So close. It came so close. You tried to get a do-over, the guy from Caesar's Palace. Well, there was a little bit of damage, so it went back and forth, and he finally said, no, you can't have a do-over. But this is the kind of shit we did. Somebody in the chat room said, Mark, how does it feel to get paid to do stuff like this?
That's pretty nuts. We once had a guy call us, and he was serious, and he said, do you guys have, like, jobs in the afternoon? Because he couldn't believe that we would make enough money doing that to actually pay for a life.
Wow. Well, and
yeah, this was work.
It was work. It was a blast, but it was just silly, stupid fun. There was nothing like it. You know, we're talking with Mark Thompson, if you're just joining us. He's half of the legendary radio duo, Mark and Brian, with whom I worked. I produced from 1990 to 94. And, you know, during that time, something else we never, ever talked about, Howard Stern came to town. And you dealt with him. Now, you know, I'm so glad you said it because I say it all the time. Howard Stern would go into a new market. He would find out who the number one show was. He'd go after them with a vengeance. And of course, Mark and Brian was number one in LA. And he came to town and just went off. We had a policy. We never talked about him, but we also never listened to him. I never heard his show. But he would say that Mark and Brian stole my act. Your act was nothing. We didn't know what he did, first of all. And second of all, couldn't be any further from what he did, ever.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was his standard line to call the other team morons and losers, and they stole my act, which is a blatant lie, because as Nicole just said, I had heard of him, but I had never heard him. And I don't know that anybody could steal what it was that Howard did, but... I do believe at that time when Howard was doing that, this was fresh after the television show with NBC. And I felt like because of the kind of a show that was, and because it was an abysmal failure, we were ripe to be picked.
But, you know, yeah, the TV show. And I'll tell you something. The TV show was sort of when things started going wonky in the studio as well. It just wasn't as much fun because we'd get off the air and you guys would bolt and you'd be on the phone so I could get you on the phone. But as I'm planning, you know, the Christmas shows and the birthday shows and the parade, and you were not physically in the building, and it was always, I was sharing you with the TV producers, and it took a lot of time, and obviously it was stressful.
Well, it was too much. We were working 21 hours a day doing the radio show and then doing the television show. And it just, you know, I guess the adage of be careful what you wish for. We were very successful, and that's why television came knocking, because they felt as though maybe the same thing could happen for them that happened with the radio. But what Nicole is saying is true. We were so busy trying to do a good job on the television show that we allowed the radio show to suffer. And so it was just... In hindsight, it was just a wrong move from every single level. But there's no possible way that you can know that at the time.
No.
And so, yeah, I mean, if I could go back, I would just, first of all, nobody ever said to me ever at the beginning of the process that this was going to be a children's television show. Right. They were trying to attract kids with our show, and I would have told them immediately, that's not who we are.
Right.
That's not what we do. And so, that happened. You know, we did participate in it, so I'm not blaming anybody. I just would have liked to have known exactly what it was they were shooting for, because we wasted a lot of our time in shooting trying to be funny for the same kind of people that enjoyed the radio show. And the radio show was a PG-13
Easy.
Plus.
Right.
Kind of a program, and this television show, even though we were throwing out that kind of humor, they would just cut it out.
Wow.
And so it was a bad move on our part. Didn't know it at the time.
Right.
In my opinion.
No. And who could know? And you know what? The show was funny for what it was, but it wasn't you guys. And what they wanted was you guys. So it was a miss there. And I guess that was the first major misstep. And it was right when Howard came to town. So, you know, and so he just went off on you. And, you know, I still can't listen to him to this day, though I did listen to his Bruce Springsteen interview, and it was fucking brilliant. Bruce.
Yeah, I haven't seen it.
Oh, God.
He's an amazing interviewer.
He is. He is good because he just asks the questions that come into his mind. He asks what he's thinking. And so I give him that. I still have a hard time listening to him, though. Again, going back to hearing, you know, they stole my act. You didn't steal anything. Just an example. We're getting ready to move. So I'm going through, and I'm a pack rat, and I have all kinds of crap piled everywhere. So I've been dubbing off tapes and finding videos and things like this. I remembered this bit from, I don't know what year it was. Maybe it was 90. Do you remember when Stephen Bochco had the TV show Cop Rock?
I do.
Okay. Do you remember the bit we did around it?
I do not.
Okay. It was a much longer bit. I'm going to play you one small piece of it that I still remember to this day. And when I found it on this tape, it cracked me the fuck up. It's just, we'll see if people have the same reaction. Here we go.
You know, we're still talking about the television show Cop Rock.
You know, and just a brief synopsis, again, if you just joined us, for God's sakes, what this is a weird show done by a guy who's got a great track record on shows, Stephen Bochco.
He did L.A. Law and he did Hill Street Blues. I mean, the guy's got a track record. But now he hangs himself out there with a drama about cops and courtrooms and such, but they sing, too.
Yeah,
in the process.
Like, you know, they do any kind of crime situation, I guess, just like your basic cops are called 911 or whatever. They'll just get into it, and then suddenly everybody will break into song.
And see, again, our interests were piqued when we heard about this. So with our heavy connections, as we told you, we're pretty heavy cats in this company.
They sent us a video of the actual show that will be airing next Wednesday night.
We pulled some strings, and we got a scene that we're going to just kind of share with you here right now.
The penitentiary, where the measure of a man is calculated by the severity of his crime. We take you to San Quentin, the federal maximum security lockup, where three criminals, complete strangers, incarcerated in one cell. This rare opportunity now, we hear each offender size up the other. Let's listen in.
Hey, hello, Felix. How you doing?
How you doing, man?
I'm new in the cell.
Hey, what you in here for, man?
Well, I come from the country, so maybe you read about me in the paper. I smuggle drugs.
Whoa, you smuggle drugs?
What are you in for, man?
That's pretty weird. It's okay, I smuggle drugs.
What about this other fella? What'd
absolutely uncanny. I'm a Century City attorney. I smuggle drugs.
You smuggle drugs?
Yes.
I smuggle drugs.
I guess what we're saying is...
We smuggle drugs! It's a really weird man, see, because I smuggle drugs!
You smuggle drugs?
I sure did!
That's an amazing thing.
And what did you say about yourself?
Uncanny, I smuggle drugs.
Man, you smuggle drugs.
A Century City lawyer and everything.
Wow, and you?
I smuggle drugs.
I smuggle drugs.
I smuggle drugs.
This is too weird, man. This is really
what
weird.
What about now?
I smuggle drugs.
I smuggle drugs.
I smuggle drugs.
This is really weird, man. What'd you smuggle?
I smuggle coke.
Yeah, I smuggle pot. We smuggle coke, pot,
That was better than the TV show,
of course. We smuggle drugs! I smuggle drugs!
I smuggle drugs!
I smuggle drugs!
Yeah, man! I smuggle drugs!
I smuggle drugs!
We smuggle drugs! We smuggle drugs! We smuggle drugs! Smuggle drugs! Smuggle drugs! Smuggle drugs! Smuggle drugs! We smuggle drugs! We smuggle drugs!
Good stuff.
I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Where can you get that anymore?
Nowhere.
Nowhere. Exactly. You know, and I remembered that. Every time I'd hear that, da-da-da-da, I would hear in my head, I smuggle drugs. And when I found that tape, David, my husband, saw me in here one day cracking up. He said, what's so funny? And I tried to explain the bit to him. I played it. And I think he said something like, they sound very David Letterman-esque. And that's kind of what you were, throwing shit off the roof of the building, just doing silly stuff, the two overgrown kids making each other laugh.
I was a working, thriving, trying to become a better radio personality when I first saw David Letterman. I was a fan of... Tom Snyder's interview show, and I would watch it. I'd smoke pot and watch it every night. And one night it wasn't on. It was Letterman. And his first night he came out and he said, this being our first show, we did some research to find out what people in America truly want to see. And he said the result was obvious. People want to see two pieces of metal being welded together. And he proceeded to do the entire show with exactly that, a welder behind him,
right,
welding metal together. And as ridiculous as it was, I couldn't take my eyes off of it. And David showed me, and Brian showed us both, that stupid things that don't make any sense have an absolute place in the world of entertainment. And once I kind of learned, it just opened the world. It opened up every door because you don't have to have an explanation. If it's funny to you, then do it.
Right.
Not everything we did was funny, but more than likely we would get you, you know, 5 out of 10.
Yeah.
6 out of 10.
Yeah.
And so it was a valuable lesson.
And some of them fell flat. And when they'd fall flat, we'd laugh at that. It's like, okay, well, you know, you tried.
Yep.
A big part of the show, obviously, was always the listeners. You had a kickoff party. You did a show at the Saban Theater in Los Angeles last week. And I saw that you had some listeners fly in from around the country, including somebody named Lori McCann. Lori is on the phone from Portland. Lori, say hi to Mark.
Hey, Mark.
Hello, Lori.
How are you?
Quite good. Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. And I can't thank you enough for the amazing show that you put on. It was so much fun. The friends, everyone, it was just a blast. You and Laura and Nicole, what a show. Thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Oh, well, thank you for flying down and going to it. We really put our best foot forward and gave it a 100% effort. And I felt like it came off, for the most part, it came off quite well. And I appreciate you coming to it.
Well, thank you again. And Nicole, thank you for having me. And I don't want to take up any of your time.
You're very welcome. Thanks for coming. Thanks for being there.
Okay. Love you guys.
See ya.
Bye. We had a few people call, and I just wanted to get at least one caller in because, you know, look, you guys have been off the air since 2012. So 10 years, and they're still rabid. There are Facebook groups. There are, and you can sell out a show in L.A. and sell out this book. And that's got to feel good. There's lasting power there.
It does. I mean, I was aware when I was deciding that I was going to write the book that it was a small book for a small group of people, because there's no way of knowing exactly how many of Mark and Brian fans are left that would want to spend money for a book like this. But my direction for the book was simply to tell the story that was happening behind the scenes while other people were listening to it and what was going on. And Mark and Brian was always very charitable. That came from the heart. We meant that. And I wanted this book to be that as well. I wanted to say thank you to all of the many pets, the dogs and cats that I've had throughout my life, and do that with this, because I've been blessed to have made a wonderful living. I don't need a chateau in France or whatever the hell you do with a whole bunch of money. I just don't need it. So help Allison Eastwood put this thing together. So take 100% of the money from the effort of the book and do exactly that.
Right.
And the show went about as well as you could ask for a show like that to be.
So you got a taste of producing a Christmas show and a birthday show. And a birthday show.
Yeah, I did. It's and I knew it was going to be a learning curve. I did. I've hosted hundreds, but I've never produced one. And basically, a producer in this particular role is the person who decides what the show is going to be. You then have to put your own money up and hope that you get it back after you've done the thing. But also you have to deal with, there's a thing in show business, or I guess any kind of business, but it's called crunch week. And the week prior to the show, you have to brace, because you're going to lose many of the things that you've assembled for this show. I wound up in crunch week. I lost 5 people that were going to come and be a part of the show. 2 of them I lost to work. Kevin Pollak had to fly to New York for Mrs. Maisel. Sam Rubin from KTLA was assigned to go to Miami for the premiere of Avatar. And then I lost 3 people to COVID. It was every day the phone. So my kind of rule has always been with a radio show, like I would prepare a show that I would like for us to do when we would go in. And ultimately, 1 or 2 pieces that were a part of that show would fall away. They couldn't come in, whatever, you'd lose it. And I learned a long time ago to not grieve what you lost, but deal with what you've still got. And that became a valuable piece, because I immediately got to work on, okay, how do I fill the hole on this thing? So, yeah. And the other major thing that I do, especially with something like a show like this, is there's much to be done that I don't have any clue how to do it. So I hired the very best people who do that perfectly. And I brought them in and said, you do that, because I don't know what goes. And it worked.
Good. No, that's nice. And I saw it, some listeners posted some video online, and I saw that you took the role of the elder statesman that we always would have at the Christmas show to read "Twas the Night Before Christmas" with music.
Because Dwight Yoakam, that hick idiot, wouldn't shut up and do it. So and we were already past time. We were late as it was. So I just picked it up. And it turned out to be hysterical, because Dwight is one of the funniest friends that I have. Mm-hmm. And he was playing his guitar and singing Christmas songs kind of in between the edge. And it was completely unscripted. We didn't know we were going to do it. And it just fell together beautifully. It couldn't have been funnier.
Here is a picture of Dwight Yoakam at your birthday show, the year that we had the Andy Griffith set built in the Fun Zone, and Don Knotts came out, and there's Dwight Yoakam serenading you. You're in your sheriff's uniform, because I think you were Andy that day. That was one of the birthday shows we did. Dwight Yoakam also was at the first Christmas show, the first year I was there in 1990. But I bring that up because I mentioned at the beginning when I couldn't think who Charlton Heston was, Clint Eastwood. I did pull three different versions of "Was the Night Before Christmas." We had Burgess Meredith, we had Jack Palance, and we had Tony Curtis. And I thought, because we played all this silly shit that you would do that was just fun, stupid stuff. But the other part of Mark and Brian was the warm, tender family, good feeling goosebump thing. And it was at the Christmas show. You would have a grandmother lead everybody in Silent Night. You'd always audition for a grandmother to lead the crowd. And we'd have some big, we had Maury Amsterdam there one year, I think, too.
Wow.
Yeah,
wow.
I have a picture with him, but I guess he didn't do it with "The Night Before Christmas." Anyway, I thought maybe we'd go out with, I thought Jack Palance, I remember him as we had the book. I'd always give it to them and they'd all signed it and stuff, but he took the book, but he didn't need it. He recited this thing from memory and did it so brilliantly. But I was hoping maybe you could tell the story of Jack Palance and how you guys sent him a birthday gift one time.
Yeah, this was pretty funny. Jack Palance was he was kind of what you would think he would be. He could be curmudgeon-y, but not with us. He seemed to appreciate whatever it was that we were, and he allowed our shenanigans. And so he had a housemaid named Rosie, and for his birthday, and at this point, Jack was probably 85.
Right. He was up there.
And we had him on the phone. He was at home, and we sent him a stripper. And she was instructed that once we had him on the phone and Rosie was in on it, she opened the door and let the stripper in. And while we were talking with Jack, she started stripping in front of him in his living room as he sat in this chair. And the quote that I remember coming out of his mouth into the microphone and on the air as the stripper was naked and dancing in front of him, Jack Palance turned to his housekeeper and said, "Rosie, goddammit, take a picture." And so that's pretty much. And then the other quote that I remember is with our friendship with Jack Palance. He took our call, and I said to him, "You know, Jack, what might be fun is that we could get a theater and we could pack it full of fans of yours, and we could sit and we could watch the great film that you made." God, what is it? The film.
Not City Slickers.
No. the classic. He wore black and Shane. Okay, that's Shane. It. And we'll watch Shane together. And Jack Palance paused for a long time and into the phone. He went, "What's the point?" Well, I guess there isn't one. So I guess we won't do that. Jack, Mr. Palance. We won't be doing that. No, he was a wonderful guy, just a fun, you know, retired, older. He wasn't working anymore. And I adored that man and the way that he worked as an actor, his presence on screen, just fantastic.
He was great. And what a trip he was. He was fun. So I thought I'd whip this out.
'Twas the night before Christmas, when all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care, in hopes that St. Nicholas would soon be there. The children were nestled all snug in their beds, while visions of sugar plums danced in their heads. And Ma, in her kerchief, and I in my cap, had just settled down for a long winter's nap. When out on the lawn there arose such a clatter, I sprang from my bed to see what was the matter. Away to the window I flew like a flash, tore open the shutters, and threw up the sash. When what to my wandering eyes should appear but a miniature sleigh and eight tiny reindeer, with a little old driver so lively and quick, I knew in a moment it must be St. Nick. More rapid than eagles his coursers they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them by name. Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen, on Comet, on Cupid, on Dunder and Blitzen, to the top of the porch, to the top of the wall, now dash away, dash away, dash away all. So, up to the housetop the coursers they flew, with a sleigh full of toys, and the St. Nicholas too. And then in a twinkling I heard on the roof the prancing and pawing of each little hoof. As I drew in my head and was turning around, down the chimney St. Nicholas came with a bound. He was dressed all in fur from his head to his foot, and his clothes were all tarnished with ashes and soot. A bundle of toys he had flung on his back, and he looked like a peddler just opening his pack. His eyes, how they twinkled, his dimples, how merry, his cheeks were like roses, his nose like a cherry. His droll little mouth was drawn up like a bow, and the beard on his chin was as white as the snow. The stump of a pipe he held clenched in his teeth, and the smoke, it encircled his head like a wreath. He had a broad face and a little round belly that shook when he laughed like a bowl full of jelly. He was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf, and I laughed when I saw him in spite of myself. A wink of his eye and a twist of his head soon gave me to know I had nothing to dread. He spoke not one word, but went straight to his work, filled all the stockings, then turned with a jerk. And laying a finger aside of his nose and giving a nod, up the chimney he rose. He sprang to his sleigh, to his team gave a whistle, and away they all flew like the down of a thistle. But I heard him exclaim ere he flew out of sight, "Merry Christmas to all, and to all a good night."
And the crowd went wild.
That might have been, pound for pound, it might have been the greatest performance. Because what Nicole was saying is true. He started in the chair. We always had this big, cushy, velvety chair for the celebrity in a fireplace. And he started out in the chair with the book. And he got maybe two stanzas into it. And he closed the book and stood up. And everybody went, "Oh, my God." And then he recited that, walking the stage as an actor would and selling it.
Yeah.
It was just one of the great performances. And then another year, I don't know that we ever had a bigger icon than the year that we had Bob Hope. Word came that we were going to get him. And the demand for tickets was just off the charts to go see Bob Hope. This is Bob Hope. He's 91. And so he came out with his wife, Dolores. And Bob, being 91, I don't think he could read anymore. Mm. So he opened it and he closed it, and his wife did the rest of it. But there's a thing that's used, and the term is a Bob Hope joke. This is a joke that only Bob Hope can make funny. It'll fall flat for anybody else. And for some reason, I still remember the opening joke with Bob Hope. He first came out, and the ovation was probably 3 minutes. Mm. And you know, he's 91, so he just stood there. Wow. And let it happen. Once everybody had calmed down, Bob began with, "'Twas the night before Christmas, when all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even my agent." And he killed. I mean, the place fell out to that. And so then the ovation eventually died down again. Dolores finished it. Bob then came in with the last line, and the standing ovation started again. And this time it was louder, bigger, longer than the one before. And you know that you're a legend when you can turn and walk out in the middle of a standing ovation and it isn't considered rude.
Right. Wow. Yeah. I mean, there were a lot of legends that came through the studio. We did a lot of stuff. The trip to Saudi Arabia, you know, it was the first Gulf War. And we went over with MGM Grand. We could go for hours. I'm not going to ask you to stay for hours, but I pulled, obviously, much more than we needed. But the memories are just flooding back. You know, we left for Saudi Arabia not knowing if we were going to be able to land. We were trying to set up a sideshow because we knew we'd have to stop in Prestwick, Scotland. By the way, that's that Donald Trump airport, by the way. That we were there one night in the middle of the night. I don't know if you remember doing, there were wheelchairs there, and you and Brian were having wheelchair races.
Vaguely yes. Remember.
This was in Saudi Arabia, these pictures. I don't have a copy of the show that we did from there, but we landed there. We went with MGM Grand, who had tons of Christmas stuff. This was 1992. No, 1990. Well, around 1990, I believe. So we were there. It was 32 years ago this month.
Well, the main thing that I remember about that, everything was a blur. I think it was 91, and I think we had been shooting television. We were absolutely exhausted. We shot a local television show, a Christmas special. We took the Andy Griffith Christmas special, and we shot that.
Yes.
And then we went and we did this. The tough part about this is we were on this airplane for 26 hours. We landed. We got off. We were only allowed to be on the ground for 4 hours.
Yep.
Before we were then taken back to the airport, got back on the same airplane and flew another 26 hours. So it was grueling from that level.
It was December 17th, 1990. I have it right
90.
Here. Yeah, 1990. It was 90. I kept a journal. I wrote something that I'll post along where I post today's show, because it was the most heart-wrenching, emotional show where we had soldiers there. We were on the roof of a hotel where the press was headquartered in Saudi Arabia. We did the broadcast and got back on the plane, like you said, but we connected these service members with their family back home, and there wasn't a dry eye in the house. I mean, it was just, and getting back on that plane and then closed the plane door and leaving those young kids there while we got to go home. It was heartbreaking. So this show really took us, you know, from ridiculous, silly, stupid stuff like launching the evil kebab over the fountains at Caesar's Palace to going to Saudi Arabia and doing a show, a holiday show with the troops there.
That was another important aspect of what we did. We could be incredibly silly and stupid and doing fun things and trying to bring a giggle. But at the same time, we were human beings. And we, of course, showed that on many occasions. And I think that made us stand out because we were being genuinely true to who we were as people.
Without a doubt. And I'm going to leave. I'm going to let you go because I've kept you long enough. I so appreciate your time and you coming on. Thank you for writing the story.
I thoroughly enjoyed the process of writing the story. I don't know that I would. A unique thing about writing a memoir. In fact, I think I wrote this story in the book. Mick Jagger was offered a bunch of money by a publicist to write his memoir, and so he took the money and started. And he went about 2 weeks, and he gave the money back. And the publicist said, "What's wrong?" And he said, "I don't want to remember all that shit." Because, you know, our memory is pretty powerful. And I think what we do is we take memories, all of them, good and bad, and we kind of lock them away in a room. And when you write a memoir, you have to open those doors. And, you know, depending on how long it would take you to write that particular story, you had to live in that room with that memory, alive and moving around you. And the happy ones were easy. It was the difficult ones that came back and came back strong. There were several nights I had trouble going to sleep, and it was amazing. These things happened 30 years ago, 35 years ago. They're as powerful and as moving and as painful and hurtful as they were the day they happened. So I don't know if I would recommend it. But I think after a while, just speaking on my experience, I got a little bit used to what the process was, and I kind of understood it, but it doesn't make it any easier to dust off the really tough stuff. But, you know, I did wind up learning some things about myself and about those days and the way that I looked at them, which was differently in certain cases than the way that I looked at it before I wrote the book. Because you have a chance to not only remember it, you have a chance to look at it and study it and see it from an older person's viewpoint. So I enjoyed the process. I'm proud of the book. I'm proud of what it was that we did. And I think that we made the world a better place, not the world, but the world that we lived in.
Los Angeles, certainly.
I think we made it a little bit better place. And so if you were a fan of the Mark and Brian program, this book is clearly for you. If you're just a fan of radio, it's also to a degree a love letter to what radio used to be, to what it was when I first got into it, which slowly changed. And the book clearly explains that. And as I mentioned with Nicole, 100%, 100% of the proceeds of this book, hardcover is sold out, but the soft cover, the audio book, which I narrate, we scored various parts of it with music where it needs it, and we dropped clips of the Mark and Brian program into it. And if you're strapped for cash this holiday, the most affordable version is the ebook, and it's really good. It looks great. You get all the same stuff. It's just not printed on paper. So go to myadventureswithmarkandbrian.com, grab a copy. We'll ship it right to you. The audiobook and the ebook are instantaneous. The soft cover takes a little bit, and we'll ship it off to you. But yeah, I'm real, real proud of it. I'm glad I did it, and I hope you enjoy it.
Well, and I did. I read it. I absorbed it in about 2 days, and I was a little disappointed that I found the mention of me. Page 80. Brian and I were standing in our producer's office one day when Don called and calmly said, "I want you both to exit the building immediately." I remember that day. That's me, the producer in the office.
Well, I did say your name for the record.
You thanked me at the end. I got to thank you. I was one of the producers. Hold on. My husband wants to say hello.
Hi, Mark. I want to tell a story. So I was never, I lived in Los Angeles, but it was before you guys were on the air. I was there like 77, 78, 9. At any rate, years later, and I'm talking, this was what, 2011 maybe. Nicole and I were in Los Angeles, and we got together with my former best friend and a couple of other buddies of mine from college for dinner.
And we're sitting there eating dinner, and we're talking about, you know, who everyone is. And the most people, you know, the buddies knew me, but they didn't know Nicole. And so somebody asked Nicole, so what do you do? And she said, well, I'm on the radio. And they said, really, what type of radio? He said, well, I do political talk. And she said, I used to be on the radio in Los Angeles. And they said, really, what did you do on the radio? And she said, well, I was on the Mark and Brian show. And my former best friend's then girlfriend said, you were Nicole? And it's like, I still am Nicole. But that was the impact that it had. This girl who had never met Nicole before, because she was on your show, it's like, you were Nicole?
I still get that. I still get that today. And, you know, it's been 28 years, so yeah. Still get it. Because people remember. So, we had some amazing musical guests, both in the studio and on the Christmas shows, for sure. You wrote about Kenny Loggins' Celebrate Me Home from the Christmas show, which brought the house down, which was amazing. But there were so many others, and I figured I'll go out with one of them. But we went to see Bonnie Raitt a couple of weeks ago, and Mark Cohn opened for her.
Oh, sure, sure.
And, you know, Mark was such a friend of the show. When the first record came out with Walking in Memphis, we actually, he did a house concert for a listener. It was a prize that you gave away, a backyard concert at somebody's house.
I remember that.
Right? And then he came on the Christmas show, and he had just written a new song that he told us about, but we had never heard it before. And it was a song for his new child and called Things We've Handed Down, which still to this day makes me cry when I hear it. And I think when Linda took the pregnancy test and it came up positive, that I segued into that song. So it's always had a special place. But music, you know, you guys weren't the most musical, but music was a big part of that show as well.
It was. I mean, I wrote about this one in the book. We had been approached by the program director, gave me a CD, and the name of the CD was Woodshed Diaries. And I was told that the record company, I think it was EMI, that they really believed in this band. Would you listen to it? See what you think, maybe have them on. And we did. We had them in the room. They came in, performed, blew the roof off. And then right before they released their debut album, they changed the name from Woodshed Diaries to Yourself or Someone Like You, which, of course, that was Matchbox 20.
Oh, wow.
And they were amazing when they did it. And then, of course, after they became big stars, they wouldn't take our calls again.
Of course.
But yeah. But yeah, you're right. We had some fantastic, I mean, it's hard to imagine some of the biggest names in music that performed 3 feet in front of you.
At 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, in the room. It's truly a gift that I had the opportunity to do that. And it's my fondest, greatest, the thing I'm most proud of.
And you should be. Congratulations. Mark Thompson, great catching up with you. I got tons of stuff. If you want, you know, videos, I'll send them to you because I've got them here. And you know, like the Elvis Kebab launch over the fountains at Caesars. Oh, my God. And, of course, the Capitol Records building, one that I'm still editing. But I'll send you links when I get them done. I thought I'd leave us with a performance from the 1993 Christmas show. Greg Lake was on the year before and did such a great version of I Believe in Father Christmas that the following year, Mark Bonilla, friend of the show, who was often in the house band, was playing with Keith Emerson. And Emerson, Lake, and Palmer with Mark Bonilla came in and did a great performance on our Christmas show. So I'll go out with that. I'll say thank you, Mark Thompson, and till we meet again.
Thank you, Nicole. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you.
My pleasure. All right. You take care. And here's that song. Bye.
But instead it just kept on raining, a veil of tears for the virgin birth. I remember when
one Christmas morning, a winter's light and a distant fire, and the peal of a bell and that Christmas tree smell, and their eyes full of tinsel and fire. They sold me a silent night. They told me a fairy story, till I believed in the Israelites. I believed in Father Christmas. I looked to the sky with excited eyes, and I woke with a yawn in the first light of dawn, and I saw him through his disguise.
Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
After a hard-fought campaign, or should I say campaigns, it is my honor to utter the four most powerful words ever spoken in a democracy. The people have spoken.
And with that, the 2022 midterm elections officially are over, and a lot of history was made. Senator Raphael Warnock was reelected, this time for a full 6-year term, becoming Georgia's first black candidate to win a full term in the U.S. Senate. Warnock's victory also marked the first time since FDR in 1934. Yeah, almost 90 years ago, that every Senate incumbent from the party in power won re-election. But this race was closer than many expected, with Warnock at 51.4% to Herschel Walker's 48.6. But this win gives the Democrats a true majority in the Senate with 51 seats out of 100, firming up their control without the need for the power-sharing agreement that was in place for the last 2 years when the chamber was evenly divided. This will make things a lot easier for Democrats as they now get a majority on each committee instead of having everything split 50-50. Looking ahead, the path to retaining the Senate in 2024 is going to be a little more difficult for the Democrats because the map is tougher. Thanks to the victory in Georgia, it would also be a little more realistic. But they will be challenged in West Virginia, Montana, and Ohio in a presidential election year. Oy. Game on, I guess. By the way, the final makeup for the House in the 118th Congress is now also set, with the Republicans taking power with 222 seats, the Democrats holding on to 212. Note that the Democrats initially won 213 seats, but one of the newly elected Democrats from Virginia, Donald McEachin, passed away last week. One perplexing thought as we move on from this very contentious election cycle. Herschel Walker, who might just be the worst senatorial candidate in history to get a major party's nomination, his concession speech might just have been his best of the entire campaign.
I want to thank all of you as well, because we've had a tough journey, have we not? Yes. You never stop dreaming. I don't want any of you to stop dreaming. I don't want any of you to stop believing in America. I want you to believe in America and continue to believe in the Constitution and believe in our elected officials most of all.
I hate to say it, but considering how close this race was, if that was the guy that showed up on the trail, he could have won. Just saying. A Manhattan jury on Tuesday found Donald Trump's family real estate business guilty of criminal tax fraud and 16 other counts of financial crimes. The case involved a 15-year-long scheme to dodge taxes by compensating top executives with perks like luxury apartments and cars, private school tuition for their relatives, stuff like that. Prosecutors said there was a, quote, culture of fraud and deception at two Trump Organization entities, the Trump Corporation and Trump Payroll Corporation. Well, the Manhattan DA's office got the Trump's long-serving chief financial officer, Alan Weisselberg, to plead guilty and testify about the scheme, which he claimed he orchestrated. Falling on the sword much? Trump and his eldest sons, who run the company, were not directly implicated. Trump said he was disappointed with the verdict and he'd appeal. Well, I'm disappointed that Trump and his spawn weren't directly implicated. Just saying. Oh, by the way, the company faces roughly $1.6 million in fines when it's sentenced. That will happen on January 13th of 2023. So the special counsel, who was appointed by Merrick Garland to take over all of the Trump-related investigations, has now issued his first grand jury subpoenas. They went out to local officials in Arizona, Michigan, and Wisconsin, three of the states that were central to the former guy's failed plan to stay in power after the 2020 election. They're seeking any and all communications with Trump, his campaign, aides, and allies. These are the first known subpoenas issued since Jack Smith was named last month to oversee those aspects of the investigation of January 6th and the criminal probe of Trump's possible mishandling of classified documents. And the January 6th committee isn't quite done yet, even though it'll disband before the new 118th Congress is sworn in on January 3rd. But Benny Thompson, the committee chair, said on Tuesday that members of the panel had reached a general agreement on making criminal referrals to the Justice Department. Thompson said the committee still has to formalize the decision and didn't say who would be targeted in the referrals. But members of the committee had previously suggested that they might send DOJ multiple referrals related to efforts by the former guy and his allies to overturn the last election. The panel plans to release transcripts of the interviews and their final report sometime before this session of Congress ends. So have you been to a gas station lately? A sharp drop in oil prices this week is a pretty good indicator that prices at the pump will continue decreasing. The EU banned certain oil imports from Russia, and the West placed a $60 cap on Russian oil. Both moves are designed to hurt Russia's ability to finance its war against Ukraine without hurting consumers abroad. In the U.S., the national average price for regular gasoline right now is $3.35 a gallon. Gas prices have dropped 14 cents in the past week and 42 cents in the past month. So are those stickers back at the pumps that read Joe Biden did this? Just wondering. And finally, Trevor Noah is leaving The Daily Show. Thursday night will be his final broadcast. And after that, well, Comedy Central announcing that guest hosts will fill in beginning in mid-January. They include Al Franken, Chelsea Handler, Leslie Jones, John Leguizamo, Sarah Silverman, and Wanda Sykes. Well, if Trevor's got to go, I guess that's the way to go. I got to go. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. Find out more at NicoleSandler.com, and please click on that donate button.